Welcome back. As we look at Baltimore, Detroit, Oakland, on this day, we went out. You just heard Jay Dilla, last donut of the night. We are about to talk to Dr. Lester Spence, Center for Emerging Media Scholar in Residence, the man who came up with the idea for the Baltimore, Detroit, Oakland series, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University, Jeff Singer in the studio, founder and former Executive Director of Healthcare for the Homeless, instructor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work, and Dr. James Lance Taylor, Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Politics at the University of San Francisco, who got up very early to join us, and Dr. James Lance Taylor, Jeff Singer, Dr. Lester Spence, welcome, good to have you all with us.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks, it's good to be here.
410-319-8888 is the number. You can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages or tweet at Mark Steiner. 410-319-8888. When federal judge Stephen Rhodes made the statement that pension benefits are a contractual right and are not entitled to any heightened protection in a municipal bankruptcy, that sent ripples, not just through Detroit and Michigan, but across the country. Cities around the country were going, this is our chance to take on the whole issue of pensions for city workers and find new ways to deal with city financial issues short of bankruptcy. Some people said, well, this is not going to really have a ripple effect because most cities are not going to declare bankruptcy, but it's the issue beyond the bankruptcy that I think that is very telling here. Before we get into the heart of what happened in Detroit, let's think about that for a moment. In the cities that we're in, 410-319-8888. Lester.
First of all, I'm still kind of reeling from yesterday's loss to the Ravens. I'm still kind of sad about that. I just wanted to put that out there.
Well, you know, it was a good game, man.
You'll hear me laughing. And now I'm laughing. It's really painful. But so what's happening? So pensions were created as a way for municipalities to serve their obligation to people who gave service to the city, but after retirement, you know, did not or weren't necessarily working, right? So it's like it kind of provides a social safety net, and then it also takes care of an obligation, a political and a fiscal obligation that cities have to workers who provide the infrastructure, valuable infrastructure for how cities work, right? Whether it's servicing roads, whether it's trash pickup, whether it's dealing with fires, whether it's dealing with crime, right? But over the last few decades, cities have been less interested in actually fulfilling that obligation. And while they have a number of economic reasons for doing so, the way I think we should understand that move is through a political lens. That is, so here's one way to think about it. Cities could say theoretically, oh, well, we don't have the money to provide for our retired police department our retired police officers or our retired trash collectors. So we're going to argue that the nation has an obligation, and we're going to use our political will to suggest that the president or the House of Representatives actually create a program to supplement the income city workers have, right? But we don't hear that. What we hear consistently from political official after political official is that these obligations are too much for the city to bear. At most, we should transition our city workers into a program where they take more responsibility. And when they say that, what they're saying is that the government shouldn't have responsibility for taking care of basically retired workers, that retired workers should somehow take responsibility for themselves. And we know what the end result of this is going to be. It's going to be an increase in already high levels of wealth inequality, and then to the extent we're looking at take a racial analysis, and an increase in interracial wealth inequality.
And Dr. James Lance Taylor, James, talk a bit about what your perspective on this, and also, you know, in the Bay Area, but around the California, many cities are salivating from articles I've read about what this means for them.
places like San Jose taking the lead, the largest city in the state of California, are taking the lead on this, and its mayor hoping to take an opportunity, you know, seeing Detroit as a watershed for cities, as you know, Professor Spence says, to sort of abdicate their responsibilities and obligations to workers who've, you know, served and worked in cities for years. There's cities like Vallejo here in Northern California. Down in Southern California, you have San Bernardino. And these are, you know, larger areas that cities in California, which are really protected by California law and even California Constitution, probably prevents California from following suit with Detroit or, say, Birmingham or any other larger city. California cities largely are protected by constitutional provisions and that, you know, require it to meet its obligations to its service workers, public sector workers. But clearly, you know, the opportunity is there, and, you know, city leaders, city managers, and mayors see this as an opportunity to at least, you know, make appeals around the implications of what is happening in Detroit, because bankruptcy courts tend to, you know, look around the country and look for new law and new rulings that, you know, that pertain to the whole area of bankruptcy law. So for that reason, it could have some impact on California. But again, California law seems to prevent the different municipalities from following suit with Detroit. But that doesn't mean they won't try.
Jeff Singer.
Thank you. This is such an interesting and important topic. I'd like to point out that pensions, public pensions in particular, are not just a safety net. They were earned by the workers in the cities and in the states. It's part of their compensation. Public employees are paid on average less than people doing the same work in the private sector. And one of the reasons for that is part of their compensation are the pensions. It's not the teacher's fault that the cities and the states haven't contributed appropriately to the pension funds. The cities and states have used those dollars in other ways. One important way is corporate subsidies. And of course, we do that in Baltimore extremely well. But they do it in Detroit, too. They're now building a $450 million hockey stadium in Detroit while the city is undergoing bankruptcy, using primarily public dollars, the same dollars that could very easily cover all of Detroit's annual shortfall in their budget.
I think let's tackle that for a moment before we go into some of the implications of Detroit's bankruptcy and what it means or does not mean for other cities. Because we look here in Baltimore City and we see that this administration and several people in city council and others are trying to cut the pensions in the city and force people to leave the pension system and go into 401ks and what that means. So we'll come to that. But what you were just alluding to, this question of pensions, I mean, we're seeing whether it's state governments or municipalities saying that they cannot afford them, that they are underfunded. So let's argue this for a minute. I mean, what you're arguing here is that it's not the underfunding by the workers themselves and their paychecks. It's the use of the money that was supposed to go into those funds from municipalities and from state governments that have been spent elsewhere. So that this is, I think, universally, Lester, what's happening across the country. At least that's one argument.
Yeah. So I noted again, and thanks, Jeff, for that intervention. And as a side note, James, it's good to hear you. What I noted is that cities are making political choices. City officials are making political choices. Now, over the last 40 years, cities have been forced to become more entrepreneurial and to look at themselves as more as corporate entities than as political entities. But even given that they're those constraints, they're still making a range of political decisions. So he talks about, so Jeff mentioned accurately the Detroit, the decision to create a new stadium for the Detroit Red Wings. $450 million and approximately $300 million of that are coming from taxes. They built a Ford Field. The Baltimore Ravens beat the Detroit Lions in Ford Field, and that also was partially a significant chunk of that money came from city taxes. A few months ago, the Detroit Tigers lost to the Boston Red Sox at Comerica Park, also provided for by city subsidies. So these are political choices that we are city officials make, but they're not articulated like that, right? Just like this decision to try to dodge their pension obligations is not articulated as a political choice, but it is. It's a very clear political choice where people are where political officials are consistently choosing corporate actors over not just over flesh and blood individuals, but over flesh and blood individuals who've given service to the city, and then more importantly, or as importantly, they're doing so in against all economic theory, because these subsidies don't even act in the way for cities that they're supposed to.
So can an argument be made, though, that just is a quick digression, can an argument be made that if you didn't put money in the stadiums, the cities would lose money, that these are part of growing a city, that these are part of making a city vibrant and alive where people go there, that it creates revenues? You're saying no, Jeff? I can't see what James is saying, but I know you're saying no. See what James is saying as well. Go ahead.
There's study after study that shows that stadiums for private teams, now the Green Bay Packers are the only public team, so we right. honor them, but for private teams, there's study after study showing stadiums do not increase the economic activity in an area. They just divert money from another place. And we know that the Peter Angelos and Steve Bisciotti could build their own stadiums. They're making an awful lot of money. We didn't have to build them.
James?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there, very similar thing happened here in Oakland under Jerry Brown. You know, Jerry Brown had a plan. The now governor, former mayor of Oakland, had a redevelopment plan to sort of draw, you know, 10,000 mostly young white professionals who overflow from San Francisco and can't afford to live over there into downtown Oakland. And in the area that is, you know, downtown is this area known as Broadway, and there was this whole master plan that would develop a stadium in downtown Oakland for the Oakland A's that many people thought would transform Oakland as a city entirely. But Jerry Brown, didn't support it, and then Gene Kwan and a group of developers here in the region also refused to support developing a stadium in downtown Oakland, and there was a whole sort of drive to move down to San Jose, along with the 49ers that have now moved down into Santa Clara, and the Warriors are moving out of Oakland into San Francisco, to the point where there won't be, between baseball, football, and basketball, Oakland will only have the Raiders, and we all know that they've been trying to get out of Oakland, you know, for the past 20 years and get back down to Los Angeles. So, you know, it has a real impact on not just the bottom line on the receipts of a city, but it definitely has a psychological impact on a place like Oakland, which is always striving for hope. There's a great deal of investment in its sports franchises, particularly the Oakland Raiders. Without a plan that would allow a stadium in downtown Oakland, you know, many people see this as a foregone conclusion that it will lose all of its sports franchises and have a devastating impact.
We forget the NFL itself is a nonprofit, which always blows my mind. So
right.
We're gonna take a brief break. We're gonna come back to the phones. Bruce is the first caller up. We're gonna go out with Gil Scott-Heron's piece, "We Almost Lost Detroit." Stay with us. We'll be right back.
It stands out on the highway. Like a creature from another time, it inspires the baby's questions.
What's that?
For their mothers as they rhyme. But no one stopped to think about the babies or how they would survive. We've almost lost Detroit this time.
Derek May, Strings of Life. Baltimore, Detroit, Oakland, we're talking about. And what the future cities looks like, especially with this alleged pension crisis and what really made Detroit go down, which we'll be talking about in just a moment. Here on this program, before we jump back into it, remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com. We're joined by Dr. James Lance Taylor, Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Politics at the University of San Francisco, Dr. Lester Spence, Center for Emerging Media Scholar in Residence, who created this Baltimore-Detroit-Oakland series and usually co-hosted, as Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University, Jeff Singer, founder and former Executive Director of Healthcare for the Homeless, instructor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work, and you at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Jump onto our Facebook pages, 410-319-8888. Before we go back to a comment I want to get from Jeff Singer about some of the reflections in the last half an hour, let's go to Bruce in Baltimore. Bruce at 410-319-8888. You're on the air.
Yeah, so, you know, actually a couple of you guys stole some of my thunder, the stuff I was going to say. And generally, I agree with what you're saying, Mr. Stein. I agree that the pension is part of the problem, but it's not just the pensions. And they mentioned it, the stadiums, the Grand Prix, the development with X-Line, and some of it, some of it is just to create a better image and branding for the city of Baltimore, which is ridiculous. So they created a whole bureaucracy and agency called the Maryland State, the Maryland Stadium Authority. They created all these lottery games, scratch-off games, all these games that raise money for stadiums, which, fine, your sports are great, but the reality of it is all the time and energy spent on stadiums and Grand Prix and Harbor Point and that some of that development. Just think if you were to create a bureaucracy or an agency, an authority for affordable housing, projects for the homeless, to fix up the dilapidated housing, for to combine with other charities, Habitat for with the name I can't think of, the charitable organization that rebuilds houses.
You know, Habitat for Humanity?
Yeah, so it's absolutely ridiculous. And I hate to say it. I know I'm really critical of the mayor, but previous administrations have been involved in this too. The mayor really pushed this Grand Prix and really pushed it in this development with Exxon. And it was supposed to be a vote last night for bonds, $30 million in bonds or something.
Right, for Michael Beatty.
If that could be could go towards more important things in the city.
Bruce, thank you so much. I think he got that bond as well last night, if I heard correctly. But right, this is for the Harbor Point development. Bruce, thanks for your call. As usual, always good to hear from you.
Bruce is indeed right on point. As Professor Spence says, the decisions that are being made in the political arena are the ones that are causing these problems. But I want to take us back a little bit to lay a foundation. And I've been reflecting on, you know, listening to this conversation, the 60-year assault on the urban area. And, you know, in part, that's a code for a racialist perspective, right? A 60-year assault on African-Americans and other people of color who tend to live in cities because cities are wonderfully vibrant. And we've defunded cities and funded, through national policy as well as state and local, funded the suburbs for 60 years, right? For 140 years, we've had an assault on unions and workers. And it rises and falls, you know, and it changes. But particularly since 1980, there's been a concerted effort to demonize unions. I always ask my classes, do you have experience with unions? Do you have a relative in a union? And what are your thoughts on unions? And almost universally today, negative comments about unions based on nothing real emerge from the students. But there's been a very well-funded an effective assault on the rights of workers to get together and bargain to somehow deal on a level playing field with the bosses. So I think you put together this assault on cities and this assault on unions, and the product of it is Detroit and Baltimore.
And let's dispense also, because I think following up on what Jeff just said, and folks, really join us, I want to hear what you think about where the future of our cities are going, wherever you live, in the cities you're in, 410-319-8888. And whether you're a city worker or a state worker and on pensions yourself, and what your views of that are. Or maybe you have the opposite view. I want to hear it. 410-319-8888. But you know, Lester, when you look at the kind of the root of Detroit, picking up from what Jeff was just saying, I think people don't realize that, you know, that a lot of what happened there had to do with the lessening amounts of money coming from the state government as a contribution to Detroit, as well as the deals made by Wall Street and the kinds of bonds they floated and the money that Detroit owes the biggest banks.
Yeah.
We're not hearing any of that in most of the conversations, except in a couple of reports that nobody reads.
No, that's absolutely right. So to speak quickly to Jeff's point about the larger context in the city of Detroit is that Detroit started to suffer a flight around 1950 or so, and then it started to suffer business disinvestment around 1970 or so. And where those places went, where residents fled Detroit to reside in, and then where businesses end up going, those spaces were largely, if not solely, white, and blacks were actually prevented from going in those spaces. So it ended up being kind of a wealth transfer, right? There's a sucking sound, as you could hear wealth being transferred out of the city. And Detroit's been particularly given that that the amount of revenue sharing that Detroit had to that Detroit could count on from the state and the federal government diminished. It's been really forced. I talked about constraints. It's been really forced to come up with more and more entrepreneurial ways to deal with their cash, with their diminishing revenues. Now, how this relates specifically to the bankruptcy, we look at Kwame Kilpatrick, who was mayor and who was recently found guilty of basically running a gang out of the city hall. The one deal he did, which nobody's talking about, which actually was legal, which actually is in some ways related to Detroit's bankruptcy, is in the early part of the 21st century, he cut a deal with the banks that had a number of riders attached to it, that if those riders were met, so for example, if emergency financial manager was put in place, if Detroit's debt went beyond a certain amount, or if federal interest rates actually dropped a certain amount, they had to pay. The city was responsible for paying these huge exorbitant fees, and it's that deal almost solely that puts Detroit in position where it is now. But we're not talking about the politics of that, right? So there's a question as to whether Wall Street actually had the ethical obligation to actually inform Detroit about how bad a deal it was cutting. Very similar to the way we could think of mortgage agents,
right,
cutting bad deals with people on houses, right? But when we're talking about engaging in political action, we don't hear anybody saying, well, you know what? No, we should actually go after the banks. We should sue the banks. We should sue the banks on behalf of the city of Detroit. We actually don't have anybody talking about that. Instead, what we have is a narrative that blames Detroit on corrupt leadership, whether you're talking about the mayor or you're talking about city council. And that's really, really racially loaded. So because of the racism inherent in that argument, it actually leads people to be more critical of government instead of critical of Wall Street in this instance.
So let me ask this question to the three of you on two levels here. I mean, what is a mayor to do who is elected when they are, yes, for argument's sake?
Yeah.
I think you're right what you said, Jeff, earlier. in your analysis, that part of the reason that pensions are cannot be paid for is because the contributions by the state and the cities have not kept up with the workers themselves and their contribution to the pensions in the original agreements. Whether you can argue that workers should put more in their pensions, you can make that argument, but that is part of it. Part of it, you can look at private industry and see that they have decided that pensions, like what happened to the steel workers, the auto workers have lost their pensions, especially the steel workers have lost everything. So pensions are becoming like something that was some ephemeral thing that went from Roosevelt to Lyndon Johnson and then all of a sudden not became unimportant in the annals of the United States. But so what is a mayor supposed to do? What is Stephanie Rawlings Blake supposed to do? What is a mayor of Detroit or Oakland or San Francisco supposed to do when faced with what are underfunded pensions at this moment? Because they are underfunded. However they got there, they're there. And they're also faced with the power of developers saying, we want money for these parks, we want money for these developments, you got to give them to us. So what would be a response? Let's just talk about that. That might work for an establishment mayor. How do they respond to this?
Well, do you all remember when Dennis Kucinich became mayor of Cleveland?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
Cleveland was in relatively poor financial shape. He changed that. He nationalized, essentially, the utilities. And that was one way that the city became stronger. And mayors could do that today, not just the utilities. But, I mean, can you imagine nationalizing Constellation Energy? Nationalizing, you know, having the city control it, having the people of the city own Constellation Energy, which would save money for every person who heats a home and lights a home, but would also prevent drains on the city's treasury. Then we could have a progressive tax structure in the city, not based on property taxes, based on income taxes, and people who are wealthy would pay more. Now, would more people move to
the suburbs?
The county? All right, perhaps.
Maybe.
But that's why this can't be, you can't build socialism in one city, but you can start building a progressive politics, and then you can organize with other cities because there's so many cities in the same condition. And every mayor ought to be reaching out to every other mayor to organize with them to change urban policy, which has disinvested in cities for 60 years, as I've mentioned. These are some of the things that a mayor could do. It won't change the situation tomorrow, but it would create a whole new spirit of adventure in the United States and in Baltimore.
You think of James, you think of the progressive mayors and city councils that have been elected on New York City and Seattle, some other places. I mean, so I think the question is not an unreasonable question to ask, what is an establishment mayor and leadership to do?
So it's interesting because one of the most powerful political organizations that mayors have is the National Conference of Mayors. The National Conference of Mayors was actually founded in part by Detroit's mayor in the early 1930s, if not earlier, as a response to the Great Depression. Mayors, cities were hard hit by the Depression and wanted to levy their power, wanted to aggregate their power in order to get the nation to deal with it. So you have what I think they can do now, right? What they can do right now is like actually use the bully pulpit to actually speak to what's happening, lay bare the politics of their decision making, and then by laying that bare, by opening that up, they actually open the door for forces within the cities and outside of them to actually mobilize against basically a corporate takeover of these cities.
James?
Now, I mean, in a place like, you know, Oakland, I mean, where you have this strong mayor of arrangement that Jerry Brown finally mustered from the city manager, or someone like San Francisco where, you know, where there's a city and a county combined in one, unusually, where it's actually the county and city of San Francisco, you know, you have to deal with, you know, kind of going back a little bit to Lester's argument about the sort of political nature of pension issues as it relates to the structure of government in a city like Oakland and, say, for example, San Francisco, where I work. You have the real challenge of the structure of the government itself, the city manager versus mayor, the strong mayor versus strong city manager arrangement. And here in the city of Oakland, for example, the mayor is strong now, and they can try to do experimental things. But for example, in Oakland, going back to the 1950s, I mean, the problems that Oakland's facing in terms of its original police and firemen retirement program has been in trouble for over 60 years, off and on, and the borrowing has been ongoing. So Oakland borrowed about $40 million recently to cover just the pensions and to avoid taking out of a general fund. But down the line, in about 2027, this money, about $400 million, including accrued interest of $100 million, will be due. And so as much as in the case of Oakland, what city leaders have done is kick the can down the street, in the short term, retirees will reap the benefits. But, you know, the generation of workers who are going to retire in 20 years don't have much hope. And there's some suggestion that the kernel, the seeds for a Detroit-type bankruptcy are already being set here in the city of Oakland, California.
That's very interesting. Let's go to the phones here, 410-319-8888. As we expand the series, Baltimore, Detroit, Oakland, and in some ways we could argue that Baltimore may not be too far behind as well, but we'll look at that in a moment. 410-319-8888. Russ, on the east side, you're on the air.
Greetings, Mark, to you and your guests.
Hi, Russ.
Two things, Mark. I trace this pension fund crisis back to the passing of ERISA in 1978. Democrats did it. Was that in
74? Jeff said.
The name of it is very misleading because it says Employee Retirement Income Security Act, but it did nothing for employees and everything for employers, because that's when we went away from defined benefit plans more into this contributory plans that led to the 401s. Which is my second point, that we have to be careful with the 401k, because one of the last good interviews that Jay Hancock did before he left the Sun was with the guy who found the 401k loophole in the tax code.
Oh, right.
And he made it plain that what he was trying to do was enhance pensions, not replace them, that the 401k is not designed to be a standalone pension program. So I think we have to really get back on our jobs, because, you know, there was a time, Mark, in the 80s where companies were being bought and sold because of what was in their pension fund. If I remember, Colbert, Kravitz, and Roberts, and Michael Milken in that crowd. Mm-hmm. And the only difference today that I see, they're doing the same thing, but back then, Milken went to jail. Now people are just padding their bank accounts. Thanks for the time, Mark.
Thank you, Russ. You make some very strong points.
That's very good. By the way, ERISA doesn't even apply to public employees and pensions. So there are no protections.
So, and it began the downfall of the private protections. But I think the other part of this pension issue that we don't talk about, which I wasn't going to get into today, but just struck me as Russ was talking, was there are a lack of ability in this country to control health care costs, to control insurance companies, to control pharmaceuticals. And that is part of the issue when it comes to the benefits and retirees as well. I mean, because it's and that's hard for a city mayor to address.
Yeah, I think that these issues, so I talk about the bully pulpit, like one thing that city mayors could do is actually argue for something like a national pension. I mean, something to actually take these obligations and actually argue that they're not just city obligations, they're national obligations. Right. And then that way you have, you know, you can actually imagine, and granted, I'm a political scientist, not an economist, but by making that argument, you actually provide an opportunity to reduce costs by just broadly distributing them. Right. So that's one thing. But the other thing is that the thing that when making the transition to the 401ks, I talk about unpacking the politics. There are two types of political dynamics going on here. One is that 401ks are managed, right? So we have, in my case, TIA CREF manages my pension, my 401k. But in all these cases, there are fees that basically go to finance capital. So again, we're talking about taking public funds, and in this case, public funds, and actually redistributing them to finance capitalists, the ones who got us in this mess. And then the second, relatedly, is that once you're in a 401k, the reason why they don't want that to be the sole, the end-all, be-all of retirement is the 401k is totally subject to the market. And we know, we all have stories, horror stories, of people who lost all their retirement,
right,
not because they did anything wrong, not because they gambled it in the casinos, but because they put it in the market, and when it came time to collect, it was all gone.
So, and so, James, I mean, bringing you back into the conversation here again, I think that when you look at these three areas we're talking about, Baltimore and this area here and Detroit and Michigan and the Bay Area and Oakland, I'm really curious what we all think, what the future portends then. I mean, when you just said, which kind of was a bombshell for most people to hear,
right,
that Oakland could be on its way to a bankruptcy,
right,
that would affect more than Oakland, would affect San Francisco and Berkeley.
Yeah, it would affect this entire region. I mean, there's a very diverse, this region is very diverse in terms of the dot-com, industry, et cetera. But it would definitely have a ripple effect regionally. And, of course, you know, kind of going back to what you know, Professor Spence was saying, a lot of this is public relations in some way. You know, the stigma of Oakland as a negative place, like Detroit, like Baltimore, you know, which is a sort of euphemism for, you know, as both other commentators have said, these sort of racial ways of, you know, of looking at city government and cities in general. Oakland has a PR problem, an image problem, and quite frankly, after Jerry Brown left, and what Jerry Brown did was created a situation in which there was this large influx of young professional white workers, mainly around Silicon Valley, because Oakland is much cheaper to live than, say, San Jose or San Francisco. And so you would think, in the long run, that the influx of this labor force and a relatively affluent labor force that has, you know, very little, that are much, you know, they're not much of a burden on the system itself, being young and in terms of health care and child care, et cetera. In the long run, this should bode well for Oakland, that you have this large influx of young professional whites. You have an out-migration of African-Americans. Oakland's lost about 20,000 black people since the 1990s. Its population is now down to 28% of the population when it had been up, you know, as high as 50, above 50%. So Oakland, you know, I guess what I'm trying to get at is there's this sort of image problem that Oakland is a negative place, and how do you overcome a place with a negative reputation? And the truth is, when you're here on the ground in Oakland, you know, Huey P. Newton made very clear that Oakland is two places. It's the flats and it's the hills. And the hills of Oakland carry, you know, the revenues of you know, for the entire city. But the image problem that it has, you know, is a real problem. Even as it is in reality a different place than it was, you know, when Huey P. Newton and the Black Panthers were active in the 1970s. Oakland, when you walk around here, is a very diverse city. You don't see the crime. You don't even know this place has a negative image until you turn on the radio or television or read the newspaper. But in terms of daily experience, it's not there. So Oakland should do well in the long run with this large influx of workers. But the you know, the tea leaves suggest that Oakland is in trouble. In terms of because of previous decisions made by leaders going back 40, 50 years around pensions and retirements, and they continue to borrow against the future, and this isn't bode well for Oakland and the entire region.
Mostly in Baltimore also, Jeff, has this influx of young, white, upwardly mobile people moving into the city. Also has this image problem. We don't have the hills and the flats. We have Guilford and Guilford on either end of the city and the wire.
We do. We have Ruxton Road and Ruxton Avenue.
Right.
But, Mark, you had earlier mentioned health care, which is an important part of this city finance and pension issue, and maybe Professor Taylor can help us with this. But 15 or 20 years ago, I was in San Francisco, met with the health commissioner, who was designing a single-payer system for the entire city of San Francisco. And, in fact, that could also encompass Berkeley and Oakland. A single-payer legislation has passed in the California state legislature twice, but it's been vetoed by the governor. But to get back to the cities, cities could create single-payer systems and save enormous amounts of money.
How about it work in a city?
Oh, we can talk about that on another show. But it's not the best idea, but it's better to do it on a national or a state level in Canada, but it could be done, and it saves about 30% of the cost of healthcare that just go to fund insurance companies and their corporate executive salaries.
It's a really interesting thing that you just also raised, that in California, the state legislature, which is probably more progressive than the governor, passed this twice, vetoed by Governor Brown.
Right.
But it also might, that in the other end, that's why this is such a mixed bag when you look at where the future might hold for the United States. That's a mixed bag. You look at what a more progressive governor in California might do that would affect Oakland and other cities, that could change the paradigm. Perhaps. So, I mean, maybe. So, closing thoughts very quickly. What our conversation said about perhaps the future of the cities we're in and the future of the American city. Let's take a very quick thought, and we'll go to James and close out with Jeff.
So, we have two visions. So, the Detroit bankruptcy, at worst, what it'll do is it will create a set of precedents that will use to further cut. Support for the public good in the cities, whether you're talking about pensions or you're talking about other city obligations. But at best, what it actually does is it creates the opportunity for people to organize and to organize on behalf of a combination of progressive policy and the election of more progressive public officials.
James?
Yeah, and you look at, you know, somewhere like Oakland, where, you know, you have the problem of crime, the image of crime, you know, you have the problem of Oakland's future, in terms of, you know, laying off 10% of its police forces. You know, it's a great place in a great location in terms of the diversity of the workforce. You know, it's almost like this vertigo effect that the image of Oakland is, you know, that it is this dangerous place, and if you come here, you have experienced negativity. I've been here 15 years. I've never had even remotely close to an incident around crime, and, you know, directed at me. So it's not the monstrosity that people have tried to make Oakland out to be. And I think it has great potential, but its problem is serious in terms of its future, its debt, in terms of the balloon payments that are due in around 2027. You know, something like $600 million will be due in Oakland, and part of that is, you know, covering its pensions. It has more than $2 billion in underfunded pensions for workers and their health care and their spouses. And so the future does not bode well for Oakland, and I hope we're not here in 20 years saying the same thing about Oakland that we are these other large cities.
I hope not either. About a minute left, Jeff Singer.
There was another governor of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger, who was in a series of movies about the Terminator, and the central theme of those movies was really important. There is no fate but what we make. Sarah Connor taught us that, and we need to act upon it.
Great way to end this conversation. Thank you, Jeff Singer. Jeff Singer, founder and former executive director of healthcare for the homeless instructor now at the University of Maryland School of Social Work, constant commentator here on the Mark Steiner Show. Dr. Lester Spence, who came up with the idea of the Baltimore, Detroit, Oakland series, Center for Emerging Media Scholar in Residence and Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. James Lance Taylor, Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Politics at the University of San Francisco, who got up really early to join us. Thank you, James. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lester. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
We're going to get a very brief break. Another segment of Baltimore, Detroit, Oakland. We'll be back with us next month for probably a two-hour special as we advance our series. Right now we're going to take a brief break. Around the top of the hour, come back. It's time for Sound Bites. We look at the 30th anniversary of the Chesapeake Bay Agreement. What has it done to our bay? Not what we hoped it would do. We'll be right back. We are going out with The Coup. Dig it. Stay with us. An Oakland band. Never spend money.